Hello, I'm Terry Foran, and I'd like to welcome you all to today's Health Ed Women's and Children's Health podcast. Today, my guest will be Rebecca Sard, and we're going to be talking about children with rare diseases, and in particular, children with epidermolysis bullosa, or EB. Though these diseases are rare, their impact on families can be enormous. That impact and how primary care clinicians can become a meaningful part of the management team are both areas we'll be specifically exploring today. Rebecca is an experienced pediatric clinical nurse consultant specializing in dermatology. Her interests lie in the rare disease space, and she holds a very special interest in epidermolysis bullosa. She has a demonstrated history of chronic and complex care coordination within hospital and community settings, and is a highly skilled health educator with experience in health promotion and project development. She holds a Master's of International Public Health from UNSW Sydney. Rebecca is currently a clinical nurse consultant at Sydney Children's Hospital in Randwick. Rebecca is also a nurse educator for Epidermolysis Bullosa with Independence Australia, who currently administrate the National Epidermolysis Bullosa Dressing Scheme, which is funded by the federal government. Hello, Rebecca, and welcome to today's Health Ed Women's and Children's Health podcast.
Hi, Therese. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be able to talk about EB and my work with rare diseases with you.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. I was absolutely fascinated to read in your bio that you have such a special interest in rare diseases and specifically epidermolysis bullosa. Can I ask what sparked that interest and how you got to where you are now?
I work in my clinical role at a hospital that is actually a statewide referral hospital for children in New South Wales who have EB. And the ward I worked on for quite a few years, it used to be a high dependency infant toddler ward. So pretty much all the babies in the state that were born with a severe form of that condition would come through our ward. So I would say that probably for the last 20 years, most of the people who've worked in my role have been exposed to that work through clinical ward work and taken an interest and gotten to know the families and been able to move into a more of an educational or nurse consultant role to support the families.
So Rebecca, right back to basics, how do we actually define a rare disease?
So a rare disease, there's actually quite a few definitions around. There's an Australian organisation called Rare Voices has a great definition on their website. We've actually got a link to that people will be able to look up. It says that rare diseases affect less than 1 in 10,000 people. So when we're talking about EB, I work with a disease that actually in general has an incidence of 1 in 20,000, but some of the more rare subtypes of the disease I work with actually have an incidence of 1 in 100,000 people. So it starts to spark the thoughts of all of the problems that this might start bringing up. There are lack of exposure, people not having encountered it, lack of specialists, parents having no idea what this diagnosis might mean. It's quite a unique position to support a family and work with health professionals with a rare disease.
So Rebecca, can you tell me a little bit more about EB? Because I understand you'll be using this condition to illustrate some of the issues that we'll be talking about during today's podcast.
Absolutely. So EB is a rare genetic skin disease. It can be a dominant form of inheritance or a recessive form of inheritance. So sometimes families will know that they have EB in their family. That's the dominant form. So their child will have a 50% chance of inheriting it. But sometimes it's a recessive form. So they have a 25% chance of inheriting this disease. And usually these families don't have any understanding of what the disease is, and they've often never heard of it. So there's different layers in the skin that require different types of collagen or keratin genes to help bind the skin together. When you're missing just one of those genes, any type of friction or sharp shearing force or repetitive action on the skin can actually cause the skin to blister or to break down. If it's a sharp single force, it can cause a large wound instantly on the skin. And when you consider how many occasions in life we experience friction, from having elastic in our clothes, brushing our teeth, chewing hard food, wearing fitted shoes, having elastic around the top of our socks, All of these things would impact or cause wounds or blistering on people who are living with EB. It's a very debilitating disease, and in some cases it can be quite fatal.
Rebecca, why do rare diseases need to be treated differently to other conditions?
I'll talk a bit about this from my clinical experience. Working in a specialist centre, it can work very well to have all of the specialists in one location. So for EB, we need dermatologists, paediatricians, dietitians, physios, OTs, geneticists, nurses, surgeons. There's a very large team of people. So to have one specialist centre where people are skilled and understand what's going on can really help people. However, Australia is a very large country. So if you live 6 hours away from your specialist centre, any type of care that you require, any time your child becomes unwell or their care plan changes, it can be really difficult managing that disease. So each time a family seeks any type of care, they're often required to step into an educator's role, and they need to start explaining to the health professional that they've gone to for support. They need to educate them on what their child has and then step back and allow that health provider to then go on to recommend a treatment plan or a management plan. So the emotional and the social and financial burdens on these families is really big.
Rebecca, I think you've alluded to it in the answer to that question, but can I get you to run through any other challenges that you think that are important when you have a family with a member who's living with this such a rare disease?
So we can talk about the burden on the family. It's quite significant. So time off work, travelling to specialists in other cities, the emotional burden of needing to explain yourself, particularly for some rare diseases that are visibly hidden diseases and people don't understand the complexity of it or the severity, or, you know, some of them can be potentially life-limiting and people don't understand what's going on. Needing to explain themselves every time somebody asks what's wrong with your child can be really difficult. It can stop people going out. These families lose the ability to have any type of peer support because they don't have a network of people around them who have a lived experience or can demonstrate that, you know, you will get through this. So they can feel very emotionally isolated, and they often can be physically very isolated as well from other families or from their specialist centre. The delays in diagnosis for rare diseases is really significant across the board for all rare diseases. So from being referred to multiple providers to not selecting correct genetic panels, or, you know, just being referred from one hospital to the next some of our families have gone through 9 different health professionals before they arrive at our specialist centre. So we're able to support them, but the angle that we also need to take is we need to consider how those families might feel about the disease, how they might feel about health professionals by the time they come to us. Most of us grow up, particularly in Australia, having knowledge that we have access to healthcare and that health professionals have access to information and that they're there to help us. These families often arrive to our specialist centre questioning whether they're going to another person who doesn't know what's going on, another person who's going to do unnecessary testing procedures. So there is an element of needing to communicate really clearly and gain the family's trust again to let them know that we're there to work with them, we're going to seek a genetic diagnosis and give them some reassurance that they're in the right place now.
Rebecca, that brings me pretty neatly to my next question. What do you see as the role of the GP in rare disease management?
Yeah, I think it's very varied and it depends. I can talk a lot about New South Wales. So depending on the type of rare disease and the type of care that's required. So from an EB perspective, if you're involved in the care of quite a severe form of EB of a child, if you live a long way from the specialist centre, some of the GPs that we work with are primary care coordinators. They run the management plan, they communicate with us regularly. They have the team members' contact details and regularly communicating with us about how the children are going. There are some GPs who work with a child with a mild form of the condition and live 4 suburbs away from the specialist centre. And so those families might see their GP once a year. So there's no one blanket answer, but I think in all of my research of trying to work out how to support families, it comes down to working out what the family needs, mm-hmm. how much support they need, how much reassurance they need, where they are most happy accessing their care from. So they may live close to the specialist centre, but if both parents work full-time, the child's in full-time care, there's you know, NDIS support people working with the child all the time, it might actually be that they would prefer to manage their care close to home and really use the GP as a care coordinator and have them as their primary point of contact. So for a GP to set up a meeting with the family, work out what type of care they need, how many providers are involved in their care, how often they need screening, blood work, x-rays, you know, there's a lot of different screening procedures required for EB. It can be, I think I would put it to the family to let the GP know how they would like to manage that plan. A common experience that we find with families is that they often delay accessing care because they're concerned if they're referred to another health professional that they don't have that emotional capacity to walk into a new location and need to explain who they are to another healthcare provider and what their child has. And you can't touch my child until I let you know what EB is. You can't do that screening procedure until I explain what the prevention care that's required is. So people often put off their care or put off accessing, going to their GP. If they have the trust of the GP and the family's happy to communicate, we find that people are going much more frequently and then things don't escalate to needing to go to the specialist centre so much. I think I've said that in a really long way. I'm sure I can say it in a much clearer way.
No, it was brilliant, Rebecca. But I was going to take you a little bit further on that. It sounds from what you've said that many of these families have a very hard and demoralising and a long journey to get to the right places. So what would be your advice as to the sort of things a GP should really consider when referring for screening for a rare disease?
I think letting a family know that you are in contact with the specialist centre is a really significant point of reassurance. So often the specialist centre are the primary treating professionals that these parents trust the most. Mm-hmm. So if they understand that their GP is in regular communication with the specialist centre and that treatment plan that they're providing is accepted by the specialist centre or recommended by the specialist centre, I think that's probably the most significant factor that you can do to reassure the family and maintain that level of trust.
And Rebecca, again, I think you've alluded to it before, but what are the issues around prescribing treatment for such children?
So with EB, you can imagine that any type of friction causing blistering or wounds, you know, it sounds painful, but mm-hmm. in reality, just recommending 6-monthly blood screening, giving a blood form and saying, you know, let me know how you go, you know, I'll give you a call when the results come through, I'll send a copy to the specialist centre, you might be saying all the right things, but if the person that they're going to get the blood test from doesn't understand what EB is, applying a tourniquet to a person with EB could leave them with circumferential wounds all the way around their arms that could take 4 to 6 months to heal, and in some forms of EB could leave lifelong scarring. So it's pretty significant. People might delay that blood test and say, oh, I know it's supposed to be done each 6 months, and I know there was a concern, which is why you've contacted me. I might wait until I go to the specialist centre in another 6 months. Mm-hmm. And that's not ideal. You know, we really need to manage micronutrients and all sorts of things in children with EB with their blood work. So reassuring them that I've spoken to this centre, this person's heard of it. I found out that, you know, Jane works every Saturday and Thursday. She's heard of EB before. It might be good if you go on those days. Just having those things on file, the same screening procedures every year, if you can provide some little just ways to ease that burden of them needing to explain themselves all the time, and linking them into a service that can support their child and not cause new wounds when the family have gone to seek care.
So Rebecca, as always, I suspect it all comes down to effective communication. But there is a question I know every one of my GP listeners will want me to ask. And that's, can you go a little bit further as to how GPs can participate most effectively in this case management process?
So case management, I see as a living document that each time a family presents for care, that document is redated and has changes added to when the next procedure is or what the current results are. And it's saved and sent back to all the people on the CC list. So the family will know what's going on, the GPs will know what's going on, the specialist centre will know what's going on. If there's any extra people who need care, even just the simple comments of, nice to see you today, how are you going? I see you've got somebody new with you, who's this? You might add, grandma's turned up. Actually, grandma's moved into the house with them. Let's add grandma to the care plan. Does she need training? Do you need the nurse to come over to provide extra training again? Are you involved in wound care? Does this mean the parents get to go out a bit more? What's the role of the social implications of their lives often directly impact the way that they access care and the ease of accessing care. So these care plans often look very long, but they can make a significant difference in how often they're likely to access their care and how likely they are to maintain the treatment that's prescribed.
Rebecca, I know that many of us will be really keen to explore this topic further. Are there any good resources or websites that you'd like to recommend?
There's lots of good resources. So I will recommend there's a website called rarevoices.org.au, Rare Voices. It has a big list of different types of rare diseases. So if you're working with a patient that has a specific rare disease that you would like to find out if they have any social support programs, any education programs, any online resources that you might be able to use or that the families might be able to use, Rare Voices is a great Australian link for some of those organisations. I work for Independence Australia. They're the current administrators for the National EB Dressing Scheme. It's funded by the federal government. And if you look up the NEBS website, we have a lot of resources, articles, care management plans. We've released a new management plan for schools, helping children to participate in school with comprehensive support now as well. Speaking of community organisation, Debra Australia is the only organisation that's set up specifically to support people living with EB. There's Debra's in lots of different countries. There's also a Debra International, which has all the clinical practice guidelines being developed for wound care, dental care, physiotherapy, occupational therapy. So Debra International has some really great resources. And Debra Australia can often support families in many financial and social ways as well. So if you find that for people living with EB, if they're not being able to manage their situation, perhaps they're not well set up on NDIS yet, linking them up to Debra Australia, they'll be able to get some community support from a non-clinical background as well. And a lot of families really appreciate being able to talk about the social and emotional burdens with somebody who's not clinical. A really great resource that was produced by the Australian government is Australia's first National Strategic Action Plan for Rare Diseases. It was published last year by the Australian government, and it's a really big step forward for Australia on a global scene to step up and join countries like the UK, and actually Europe has many individual countries and a European Rare Disease Action Plan. So it was a really great document to recognise the difficulties of managing a rare disease and bring it to a political front for people to start thinking about research and lobbying and funding. So it's a really great document.
Rebecca, we'll be sure to put those links up on our website. But I have to ask you, was Debra a real person or...?
It stands for Dystrophic Epidermolysis Bullosa Research Association.
Right.
Yes.
They say just get a great acronym. That's surely one. That's brilliant.
Yes.
Again, thanks, Rebecca, for sharing your expertise and insights with all of us today. It really has been an absolute pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you for having me. I hope that people will be able to have a think about, the social and emotional and, the background burdens of these families when they come to access care and make it a bit easier and encouraging for them to seek care a bit more frequently.
I'm sure you've helped us all, Rebecca, to really think about those issues. So take care.
Thank you.
We hope you found today's podcast useful. Just a quick reminder to keep an eye on the Health Ed podcast menu. Health Ed is committed to providing up-to-date, evidence-based information delivered by acknowledged experts in their field. So be sure to register for the next free webcast where you can enjoy a high-quality educational program delivered by Health Ed for you. It's free, you get CPD points, and it's all delivered to the digital device of your choice, wherever you choose to be. Register now at healthed.com.au. So that's goodbye from me until our next podcast. Thanks so much for listening.